Hello, this is Mark Peacock, and welcome to the Travel Commons Podcast. This is Travel Commons Podcast number 96, recorded Thursday, January 5th, 2012. This is the podcast giving the voice of the traveler. It's more about the journey than the destination. Two topics on this edition of the Travel Commons Podcast: eating and drinking with social media, and frequent flyer alliances. Well, Happy New Year to everyone here in 2012. I'm returning to work, as I'm sure most of you are. And I'm returning after my two-week sabbatical, my annual two-week sabbatical from travel, in what is a very unseasonably warm Chicagoland area. Got up to 50 degrees today. 50 degrees in Chicago in January. Gotta love that global warming. I was out in Phoenix in December for the first 2 weeks in December, and when I was there, it was only maybe 10 to 15 degrees warmer in Phoenix than in Chicago, so it has been a very, very mild winter. I ended up then doing a quick up and back to Washington, D.C., and then, like I said, was home for good on the evening of December 16th. And though we didn't have a white Christmas, I did have, in all those flights, an amazing run of on-time and even early arrivals at O'Hare, a very pleasant change from some of the past December travel odysseys that I have that I've detailed on this podcast. Indeed, my trips at the beginning of December, like I said, were some of the easiest and most pleasant I've had in a while. I mean, the combination of mild weather and light crowds really made travel almost pleasant. Short security lines, non-cranky TSA screeners, plenty of overhead space, and the reappearance of that rarity of rarities, an empty middle seat. Well, you know, it felt like, you know, kind of the Tuesday, you know, between the Tuesday and Wednesday after Thanksgiving, between, you know, it kind of, the period started there to sort of the week before Christmas. I don't know, it's sort of a, you know, as you'd imagine, kind of a tourist dead zone. And, you know, either people are either traveling for Thanksgiving or they're traveling for Christmas. They're not traveling those first couple of weeks in December. And so, you know, the only ones traveling are sort of the professional road warriors trying to close those last few deals, tie up those, you know, last few remaining loose ends before everyone and everything shuts down for the Christmas holidays. Or sometimes you run into frequent flyers doing, you know, one last mileage run to get them to the next status level. Now, I didn't need to do any mileage runs per se, but I will tell you that I did need those last two Phoenix trips to kind of re-up my top-tier status with Hilton, diamond status, and to get me back on United's red carpet with 1K status. You know, making that 1K status, or more importantly, getting the system upgrades that come with United's top status, I'll tell you, that was very timely. I'm heading over to Beijing next week, and being able to confirm an upgrade on United's 14-hour Chicago to Beijing flight, that, I got to tell you, that was one of the best Christmas presents I received. Following up, all the bridge music on this episode is from Sara Bargava's new album, Chromatique. Sarab is a friend and a longtime Travel Commons listener. I'm happy to feature his music. That cut that just played is called Exit, which, interestingly enough, is the first cut on the album. Check out the show notes for the song titles that you'll hear through this podcast and a link to where you can buy them. Tony White wrote in to ask about travel compression socks. He said, I'm not sure if you've covered this topic or not. Do you have a preference of a minimum amount of hours of travel you choose to wear travel socks? Well, Tony, thanks for the question. And no, I haven't covered this topic before because I've never used travel socks. Compression socks sort of squeeze the feet and calves to improve circulation, which helps fight feet swelling and deep vein thrombosis, sort of blood clots in the lower legs. Now, when I've flown business class on long flights, I really haven't felt much swelling, even on the sort of 16, 17-hour New York to Johannesburg, South Africa flight that I took a few years back. Now, I think it's just sort of the lie flat or near flat seats reduce the distance between head and feet. You'd think I was a doctor, but and so minimize the blood pooling in the lower legs. I don't know that. Seems like a reasonable hypothesis. Even in coach, I haven't felt the need for travel socks on, say, an 8-hour flight to London or an 8-hour flight to Honolulu. However, on a flight back from Hong Kong last year, I wasn't able to score the upgrade. And I'll tell you, during that 15 hours in coach, I definitely felt swelling in my calves. It was a full flight, so I couldn't lift my legs up for any length of time. And indeed, I saw a couple of guys lying on the floor in front of the exit row with their legs in the air. On my upcoming trip to Beijing, I mentioned that I scored an upgrade to business class on the way out, but my upgrade for the flight back is still waitlisted. And if that second upgrade doesn't come through this week, I think I'm going to be doing some after Christmas shopping for compression socks. 2 days before Christmas, Gogo, which is the dominant in-flight Wi-Fi provider, filed paperwork with the SEC for a $100 million IPO, initial public offering. Now, the filing provided some interesting stats. Gogo sells Wi-Fi on 4,000 flights a day and on 9 out of the 10 North American airlines that offer Wi-Fi, though Delta represents about 45% of their of that volume, and kind of the bankrupt American Airlines 18%. Gogo is available, they say, on over 1,100 planes, and which Gogo says is 85% of all Wi-Fi enabled planes in North America, and that they're signed up to add another 525 planes soon. Sort of, impressive stats on the face of it. But if you start tumbling the numbers in that SEC filing, you quickly find that only sort of 3 to 4% of passengers are buying the in-flight Wi-Fi service, which sort of syncs up with my experience. We've talked about this in past episodes. While in-flight Wi-Fi has, some good use cases, especially when you don't want to go radio silent for 3 to 4 hours in the middle of the day, I don't know. I think it's a niche offering. I used it maybe half a dozen times last year in 2011. And from my anecdotal observations, which really are come from looking over people's shoulders while I'm walking to and from the aft toilets, most people are, enjoying their unconnected time in the air to watch a movie, read an e-book, or play Angry Birds. It's amazing how long that streak has been going. It doesn't seem that most folks are willing to pay, 10 to 12 bucks a flight to update their Facebook status. Now, along those tech lines, a PC World article on the best airports for tech users ranks the 40 busiest U.S. airports on things like outlet availability, speed of Wi-Fi service, either free or paid, and the strength of their cellular signal, which I think is a good set of sort of basic tech criteria. Dallas-Fort Worth Airport ranks number one. Now, it wasn't number one in any single category, but earned enough above average marks across the board. O'Hare, my usual hangout, ranked number 34 out of 40, which I think is about right. Finding an available outlet at a gate in O'Hare is kind of like a grown-up Easter egg hunt, complete with sort of crawling around and looking under chairs. Everyone wants to board with a full battery pack, especially iPhone users. Apple still hasn't gotten, the iOS 5 battery life back to where it needs to be. And for me, cellular signal is much more important than Wi-Fi service because I tend to use my iDevices, my iPhone and iPad, much more than my laptop in airports. And I got to tell you, at O'Hare, the AT&T 3G service is unbelievably bad. I'll have 4 to 5 bars on my iPhone, but can't pull anything, email, web pages, nothing, which is the reason I travel with a Verizon 4G hotspot. You know, after I've gotten tired of watching the checking for mail circle impotently spin, I fire up the hotspot and bam, I got the mail. But I don't know, hitting number one for having visible electrical outlets and decent data service, you know, I don't know, that seems to be damning with faint praise. I mean, to really be a top tech airport, I think you need to have something like Qantas's setup at Sydney Airport, where they're using RFID cards and luggage tags to make check-in, bag check, and plane boarding, you know, sort of five-second events. I posted a link to a Wall Street Journal article about the Qantas setup on the Travel Commons Facebook page, and Lisa Besso commented back saying that it was a great system, you know, if it works as advertised. I tell you, I'd be willing to suffer through O'Hare's lousy AT&T service if United did something like that. Now, early in December, when my family was trying to get their Christmas shopping done, they started bugging me for gift ideas. Sitting in my room in the Scottsdale Hilton Garden Inn, which, by the way, isn't a bad place, and just kind of paging through the USA Today, listening to a podcast on my wireless Motorola headset, you know, off my iPhone. You know, I thought to myself, you know, a wireless speaker would be nice rather than having to sit there with the headset on. Now, I realize that a lot of alarm clocks in hotel rooms have plugs that let you play your sort of iDevice or MP3 player through the speakers. But I'll tell you, the quality is marginal at best, you know, except for those few hotels that have invested in the iHome alarm clocks, where you just sort of put the iPhone in. And even then, you're kind of stuck in the bedroom. Not great if you're, you know, if you've scored a room in something like an Embassy Suites or a DoubleTree Suites. So I asked the Twitterverse for suggestions and ended up with a Jawbone Jambox under the Christmas tree. My wife said she bought the special yellow edition, so I wouldn't miss it when packing up. Though the fact that Jawbone donates $50 from each purchase of the yellow special edition to charity water didn't hurt. I'll tell you, the Jambox is not cheap, but it puts out a lot of sound for a small package and has the easiest Bluetooth pairing that I've seen. Again, not cheap, but recommended. And hey, if you have a story, a tip, a question, a comment, the voice of the traveler, send it along. The email address is comments, COMMENTS, at travelcommons.com. You can use the voice memo app on your iPhone or something like virtual recorder on your Android phone to record and send in an audio comment. You know, you can send a Twitter message to M. Peacock, or you can post your thoughts on the Travel Commons Facebook page, or you can always go old school and post them right at the website at travelcommons.com.
One day you'll open your eyes to this, a dance we'd share, a strawberry kiss, hand over heart, we can watch it live.
So the first topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is eating and drinking with social media. You know, finding interesting places to eat is always a challenge for frequent travelers. I mean, when you're traveling to the same place a lot, like I do to Scottsdale, it's easy to fall into a rut going to the same places near the office or the hotel every trip. Now, when I started traveling, sort of way before Al Gore invented the internet, you'd rely on recommendations from folks in the local office, the hotel front desk clerk, a cab driver, a bartender, you know, whomever you ran into. Or maybe you pulled a top restaurant list out of the local paper or some guidebook. I mean, I remember one project in San Francisco in the early 90s. The project partner had a list of the top 100 restaurants in San Francisco. I don't know where he got it, but it was a Bible to him. We started at number one for the project kickoff dinner and just started working our way through the list. And yet, here we are, 20 years and sort of billions of dollars of venture capital investment later, and we still rely on personal recommendations. But kind of on steroids. The first wave of food social media was powered really by the multiplier effect. You weren't limited to people you physically meet. You could tap the expertise and passion of a broad group of diners and foodies for a broad set of recommendations. Chowhound, a food discussion board that I've mentioned in past episodes, is a perfect example of that. I'm still a heavy user of Chowhound. On my second trip to Phoenix in December, I was on my own for dinner every night. And so around 5, I'd hit the Phoenix board on Chowhound and just start paging through the entries. Just start, you know, hitting the page down until I found a restaurant that sort of, you know, hit my taste buds. You know, one night I ended up eating a green chili pork stew in some sort of posh Scottsdale place. The next night I had a bowl of pho in a Vietnamese strip mall in Mesa. But if the first wave was discussion board based, the current wave is smartphone based, using the GPS and camera to really sort of build and enrich those personal recommendations. Those of you who follow my Twitter feed may notice that kind of the occasional tweet, sometimes more than occasional tweet, that that I've earned a badge from Untappd. Now, Untappd is a social media app for beer drinkers, or should I say people who enjoy drinking good beer. Instead of checking into locations on Foursquare, I check in my beer on Untappd. It keeps track of the beers I drink and where I've been drinking them, allows friends to see what I'm drinking, and it awards badges for achievements, like checking in 200 unique beers or drinking a stout on November 3rd, which somebody somewhere designated International Stout Day. Now, the whole check-in thing just, you know, it's fun, and it gets you out of your hotel room. It gets me out to kind of search out local beers while I'm, you know, wherever I'm traveling. On that same trip to Phoenix, I found Papago. I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that. Papago? Papago? Papago Brewery, and it was in a Scottsdale strip mall, and I ended up trying their El Robusto Porter. I mean, it wasn't the best beer I've had, but it was something different, something new. But when I'm on the road, I've actually found that the best use of Untappd for me is discovering bars with interesting beer selections. One night in New York a couple months back, I was wandering around Midtown looking for a good beer bar, standing in some, I don't know, ersatz sort of Irish place. I fired up Untappd. It used the iPhone GPS to display nearby check-ins. People, you know, checking in saying, I'm drinking this beer in this location. So paging down, I saw some interesting beers being checked in at a place called the Rattle and Hum. Sort of a couple of clicks and I've got it, you know, pinned on the map app. It's about a 10-block walk. Wasn't a bad night. Down I walk, about 10 blocks downtown. It was a pretty nondescript place. Indeed, I walked right past it the first time. But I go inside, it's jammed and has a great beer selection. A great find, courtesy of a dozen people I've never met. And through GPS, I quickly found it. Now, another app I use is called Food Spotting. It also uses the iPhone GPS, but rather than just showing a list of nearby restaurants, it cycles through pictures of dishes from those restaurants uploaded by diners. You know, reading recommendations and, you know, scanning menus are helpful in choosing a restaurant, but actually seeing the dishes takes a whole lot of the guesswork out. Kind of my favorite use case for food spotting is to park my car in a restaurant-rich neighborhood. I've done this in Old Town Scottsdale and in downtown Bethesda, Maryland. I fire up food spotting and just sort of start cycling through the pictures. Pretty quick, I get a sense of sort of what places nearby are best matching, you know, what I'm hungry for. And then I map it with a couple of clicks or, I guess, screen presses, I guess. It works well for me, and I would like to personally thank all the venture capital firms that have invested billions of dollars in over the past number of years, all of this to help me quickly vector in on the perfect cheeseburger. Thank you. The second topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is frequent flyer alliances. Now, I've mentioned earlier that I'd returned to 1K status on United, returning to the red boarding carpet at the United gates. I also keep the 100% mileage matching, getting a bonus mile for each mile flown. The 2012 changes to United's awards program appear to reduce the bonus match for the mid-tier premier exec level down to 50 or 75%, depending on which of the new mid-tiers you hit. The interesting thing is, though, I didn't fly that much on United last year. I think I was looking at it less than a dozen flights. So, you know, just of itself, I flew just enough status miles, you know, or qualifying miles to make Premier, which is United's entry-level status tier, which, you know, by the way, you can get kind of the same benefits of that Premier-level status, you know, free luggage, you know, early boarding. You can get those benefits for free by signing up for United's Visa card. But what ended up happening was I ended up earning most of the 100,000 qualifying miles on United's partners, US Air and Lufthansa. So it's not so much that I earned 1K on United as much as I earned it on Star Alliance. Now, this is, you know, this isn't anything new. I mean, a good-sized chunk of my 2.5 million lifetime American Advantage miles are from British Airways. However, with airlines rationalizing, sort of reducing their number of seats, their flights, and more tightly coordinating flight schedules and doing code sharings with their alliance partners, these partnerships, Star Alliance, Oneworld, SkyTeam, you know, those are the big three, really become more of a way of life for frequent travelers, especially in those critical areas of status recognition, mileage credit, and mileage redemption. You know, it's not a simple situation. There are sort of core alliance members, you know, United, Lufthansa, US Air, and Star Alliance, Delta and Air France, and SkyTeam, American and BA, and Oneworld. And then there are the other partners, and these can sort of move around. Aer Lingus, for example, was part of the Oneworld alliance with American and BA, but left in 2007 to go independent, kind of like Notre Dame football, and sort of is matched up with JetBlue and United, but not Continental, which, you know, is now merging with United, while Virgin Atlantic is matched up with Continental, but not United. And then there are some very promiscuous partners like Hawaiian Airlines and Jet Airways, who seem to be on everybody's list, while others like Southwest remain single, or like Emirates, which assemble their own little group of partners. Now, international travelers have been sort of stringing these beads for 20-some-odd years to assemble their itineraries, but to have to do this domestically is a newer thing. Because United and US Air are both Star Alliance partners, United has cut back on their Chicago to Phoenix service, relying instead on code sharing with US Air. Now, I end up just booking that flight directly with US Air instead. It's sort of, you know, one less step to traverse when something goes wrong. But I end up giving them my United Mileage Plus number instead of a US Air Dividend Miles number. I'm not even sure I've got one of those. I still get to pre-board. And more importantly, it concentrates my miles into one program so I can maximize my status level. The downside? Well, US Air doesn't take the free drink coupons that United sends out to its 1K members. If they could get that whole redemption thing integrated, then it would truly be a seamless partnership. Okay, that's it. That's the end of Travel Commons podcast number 96. I hope you all enjoyed this podcast, and I hope you decide to stay subscribed. As I mentioned earlier, all the bridge music on this episode was from Sara Bargava's new album, Chromatique. The tracks were Exit, Yours and Mine, and Through the Line. Check out the show notes for a link to where you can buy the songs or, you know, splurge and go for the whole album. Remember, if you have a story, thought, comment, gripe, the voice of the traveler, send them along text or audio file to comments, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com, or to M. Peacock on Twitter, or write them on the Travel Commons wall on Facebook, or post them on our website at travelcommons.com. Thanks to everyone who has taken the time to send in emails, tweets, post comments on the website and on the Facebook wall. And so thanks again for listening. I'm off next week to Beijing. I'll be gone for a couple of weeks. So I will talk to you in February when I'm back. Take care. Travel safe. Thanks for stopping by the Travel Commons. Bye now.
Life is hell, strange bed in a lonely motel. But one thing can ease my mind, the warm woman that I left behind. From California to Carolina, she calls me up and there's nothing finer. And when the tears start falling, crying into the phone, within my heart you'll find my pictures of you at home. No matter where life takes me, how many miles I roam, I close my eyes and